So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello, and welcome to Geekfully Yoked, the world's best married Christian geek podcast. As always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
I am a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto with a PhD in medieval literature, which makes me a giant nerd.
And I'm an actor and stay-at-home dad, which is pretty much more than enough to make me a giant nerd. But enough about us. We are more than honored to welcome today our special guest, an actor and stuntman, and most importantly, former Kings Island employee, Doug Jones. Welcome.
Well, okay, you surprised me there. Former Kings Island employee. I've never been introduced with that that credit ever before.
Well, it's the one that really impresses us here.
Well, you know, I was a mime on the streets there of Kings Island around the Eiffel Tower.
Oh, yes.
If you're familiar with Cincinnati, Ohio theme park.
Oh, I spent a lot of time at Kings Island as a kid.
Well, isn't that one of your brother's main haunts?
It is, yes, but I grew up in Louisville, or my family's from Louisville, Kentucky, so.
Yeah, close enough, sure.
Lots of time there at Kings Island.
Yes, when I saw that, and I heard about that on, I want to say it was Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, that interview, I realized, I know what I'm leading with.
Yeah, well, I spent the summer of 1982 there, right after I graduated from college, as a mime going around the fountain area and the Eiffel Tower area, you know, the French street, the Paris-looking street. And so it seemed thematic, but really, you know, really it's a bunch of families with little kids that are terrified of guys with white face, you know, like. So I spent 3 months that summer just making children cry, really. So I had very low self-esteem. I really did.
Now, did you have standard, like, makeup and costumes you had to, you know, go by? Or were you able to sort of play around and, you know, choose your own thing, you know, be big and red one day and, you know, pale and tragic the next?
Oh, no. We had to be, in fact, my face I painted on myself, but it had to be approved by the park. And then my costume was made for me by the park employee, like, you know, costumer department. Yeah.
Was it the traditional black and white stripes, or did they at least manage to avoid that cliche?
It gave me some color. I looked, it was more like a French sailor looking thing. I had little suspenders and a high-waisted white pants with big buttons on them and a red and white striped shirt.
Ah.
Yeah, so we mixed it up with the color. But I did have, and I had a little like a Greek fisherman's hat. Like, so I looked like I wouldn't look wrong on a gondola, maybe, or in Venice, or I might, you know, a French sailor is what the more the look, I guess, maybe, probably.
That's okay. I like that. Now, were you able to parlay this into other theme parks? You know, were you ever Goofy? Were you ever Donald?
Yeah. Well, I thought maybe, you know, yes. Back then, I thought, oh, maybe I could have a career. Goofy was the one. How did you know? He's the tall one, of course. I thought if I ever could do a Disney theme park, that's what I'd do. But then I had to broaden my horizons above the theme park ilk and think. I wanted to reach for Hollywood and the silver screen, and yeah. So I ended up not ever pursuing the Goofy route.
That's a shame, because I think, you know what, the world needs better Goofies out there.
Oh, I think the Goofies that work the park are doing great. Those Disney people are really, really, they're wonderful. They go through quite a lot of training.
It is actually, it's remarkable. We were just there, and we were amazed. It suddenly dawned on me just the number of Mickeys that were around and how they are perfectly spaced in time, so you never see more than one at once.
Right.
But you have actually had the opportunity to work for Disney with Hocus Pocus, or have you done more than that?
I did. Hocus Pocus was, I think that was my one Disney film.
Okay.
I did. Of course, Disney Television with all the conglomerates, and you know, ABC's owned by Disney now.
I guess that's true, yes.
So I've been a Disney employee many, many times on different various TV shows, but including The Neighbors on ABC. I did 6 episodes of the first season of The Neighbors and just loved it. Talk about a goofy, silly dream come true. That's what The Neighbors was. I looked forward to going to work every day on that show.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah,
that's great.
But Hocus Pocus was my big, like, Walt Disney movies.
Yes.
Experience for sure. And you know, when that came out in the theaters in 1993, we just had our 20-year anniversary last year. Can you believe that? By the way,
it is certainly one of the great films of my childhood, I have to say.
Well, and I found that out by. Well, you know, when it came out in theaters in 1993, it kind of flopped at the box office because they didn't, you know, they were advertising it as a Bette Midler film, and it was up against all the summer blockbusters. They opened it in July of 93.
Oh, that's weird. I would have assumed it would have been like a Halloween movie.
Wouldn't you think that would be right? So it kind of tanked at the box office, but then over the years, as you know, it's ran downhill, gaining steam and growing in size like a snowball, with all the television airings and the home video market and families that had kids that really wanted to have it on the shelf at home. You know, it went through the VHS stage, the DVD stage, the Blu-ray stage. So it's had many, many resurgences. And the TV airings are every year. It's like The Wizard of Oz, something we look forward to on TV every year. So I that movie is way more popular now than it ever was. And I noticed it even went on the convention circuit, which I do.
Oh, really?
I do a lot of sci-fi fan conventions and fantasy horrors, comic book conventions. And of all my pictures laid out, you know, when I started doing the conventions in 2006-ish, my Hocus Pocus pictures were like, oh, that was you. Oh, yeah. And it was not a big seller. But then just, you know, now 7-8 years later, it's like it sells every bit as well as my Abe Sapien pictures from the Hellboy movies. It sells as well as my Silver Surfer pictures. It's like everyone loves Hocus Pocus. And they love Billy, thank goodness, the character I played.
I have a distinct memory of looking in my parents' bookshelves and seeing Hocus Pocus there on the shelf and thinking, oh, they made the movie was based on a book, or they made a book out of the movie, picking it up, wondering, who is this Kurt Vonnegut guy? I'm not seeing any witches in this. This is very disappointing. Then I went back a few years later and realized, oh, it's actually a compelling piece of literature, which, you know, doesn't need Bette Midler to sell it. But when I was in I guess I was probably like 7th or 8th grade, that did cut me, that I saw no Kathy Najimy whatsoever in that.
I know. Well, you know, the movie did not coin the phrase Hocus Pocus. That was done prior, I think.
That Hocus Pocus actually has a liturgical origin, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Hocus corpus meum.
Okay.
So this is my body. And when the Protestant Reformation came about, it was taken by the Protestants to as a condemnation of the Catholics, all of this hocus pocus.
Well, see, now this is why we need to have a geek around, isn't it? This is exactly why. I love it. Oh, good.
Now, you've already gone ahead and mentioned probably the movie that Rachel and I first discovered you in, which would have been Hellboy.
Knowingly. Obviously, Hocus Pocus as a kid, but first knowingly,
needing to know who is the fellow, you know, swimming about and dangling from midair and doing all those wonderful work, because that was truly, truly some impressive, impressive work throughout the entire film.
Thank you. Well, you know, that is the movie that became the blue speck on the radar for people. For me, I had been working for 20 years up to that point under the radar, doing lots of working consistently, but no one knowing who I was. And I did enjoy the anonymity, but then every so often would long for some attention, like, you know, wouldn't it be nice if I could be on the cover of a magazine or whatever, like other actors. But it was a page turner for me, and what really cemented my relationship with director Guillermo del Toro. That was the most important part of Hellboy for me, was that I had met him actually on Mimic 5 years prior to that, but I was only on the movie for 3 days. But we connected and shared stories about making monsters and who makes them and who does it well and what their personalities are like and blah blah blah. We had that conversation over lunch one day on Mimic. And then 5 years later, I get this phone call from the Spectral Motion Creature Shop saying, we have a director here who says he knows you, and there's a movie we're about to make, and we want to come and meet us. And that was for Hellboy. So Guillermo kept my card in his wallet for 5 years, and it was really a sweet reunion. On Hellboy, we really got to know each other, and we got that shorthand experience down where director doesn't have to say much, actor gets it right away, you know, from what is... just not many words have to be spoken, and we understand each other. He understood all my buttons and what to push to direct me, and I understood his intention and his creativity somewhat. So he's a brilliant genius mind, so I could never like I can never like pose myself as like, oh, I totally get Guillermo del Toro. No one gets him all the way because he's just so brilliant. But I do my best. Yeah. And so that experience, though, you know, then parlayed into more work pretty rapidly. And shortly after Hellboy, and I guess it came out in theaters in 2004. And then I did Doom with Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and I played and Carl Urban, and I played a few imp creatures in that, and then I did Benchwarmers with Rob Schneider, David Spade, John Heder. It was like a silly little league baseball movie that these grownups had formed their own base little league because to recapture their childhood. And this whole thing was sponsored by eccentric billionaire John Lovitz in the movie. And I was his butler. I was John Lovitz's butler, who also happened to be a robot.
Oh, well
done. That was great fun. So that was all happening after the first Hellboy movie. So I was back to being anonymous guy in suits and makeups that nobody really quite made mention of. And then I get an email from Guillermo del Toro saying that he was in Spain and he was in pre-production for this Spanish language film called Pan's Labyrinth, El Laberinto del Fauno. And so Hellboy was the first, you know, that was a page turner, but Pan's Labyrinth was the movie that changed my life, like for good. That was the movie that the press finally understood me, and the studio system understood me, and agents and managers understood that my title wasn't, you know, weird movement stunt slash mime slash dancer slash whatever he is, Doug Jones. They never knew what to call me. After Pan's Labyrinth, they called me an actor, and they were using words like movie star. I was like, oh my gosh, really? Me? This is exciting. So and that was the movie that all the comparisons started happening with between, you know, Lon Chaney, Boris Karloff. They were doing a lot of throwback comparisons to the golden era, which I just loved seeing a resurgence of that kind of respect for monsters in movies, where they were allowed to be leading men. They weren't just the freaky guy that you know, growls at people, you know?
Well, and as an actor, you've really worked remarkably well with real practical effects. One thing Rachel and I sort of, you know, we're children of the 80s, so, you know, we love all those really kind of like cheesy claymation and stop and start and kind of, you know, blue screeny sort of.
Muppet Yoda will always be better than CGI Yoda.
And yes, precisely.
Absolutely. I can't agree with you more.
And while we love a lot of mocap actors like Andy mm-hmm. Serkis, we, you know, more so love seeing the physicality that comes from just having a person there, you know, covered in makeup, presumably a lot of KY jelly, you know, and glistening and bobbing about and looking wonderful. There's a reality to it that we both of us, we like and probably talk about, you know, in a far too overly detailed theological way.
Well, you know, you're reflecting a very common voice among fans. I hear this a lot, especially doing like I said, between bigger jobs, I can go on the convention circuit and actually meet fans face to face. And I hear this more often than you would think, that they really appreciate practical effects, love what CG's been doing, and I do love the marriage of CG and practical when CG can take practical effects to a place they couldn't go before, right? I love it when there's a happy, healthy marriage between the two, but when you obliterate the practical effects altogether and just go with the, you know, the computer renderings, you as an audience and me as an audience too, I'm always aware when I'm watching it, and it makes me feel like I'm watching a video game and I'm not really quite as connected to the character. People like to watch other people. That's just kind of a human thing that we do. We're fascinated with watching someone else. That's why we like to go to the mall and sit eating an ice cream, watching people walk by. We love to watch other people. So when you take that away, if you went to the mall and just saw you know, artist renderings of people walking around, we wouldn't be quite as interested in going to the mall anymore.
That's really true.
I was just saying, you brought up Pan's Labyrinth, which for me, it's one of my favorite films. It's a fantastic piece of art, but I mean, obviously you are a person of faith yourself, which is one of the reasons why we really wanted to talk to you, but it's also a really difficult film. I mean, it's a lot of challenging content. But for me, it's an example, a great example of non-gratuitous violence. It's a film that if it weren't so brutal, it would not be so powerful and would not be so beautiful, actually. And I think very often when we think of Christian art, we can stray from things that seem dark.
I always like to bring up, I grew up in the mission field in West Africa, and there was one of the moms there. We would have movie nights, and if she hadn't seen the movie, then she would have her hand pretty much on the fast forward, you know, button, just waiting for the first sign of anything salacious or violent or occult. And you've made a lot of movies that would have gotten, you know, fast forwarded through quite a bit, which you know, makes younger Lehman very appreciative.
So I guess how do you reconcile that in your own faith, your own life as an artist?
Mm-hmm. I like to look at the entire project. Where's the entire story going? What's the message being told by the entire movie? Someone's got to play the bad guy, and I often have. You know, being a character-y person who's not like, I'm not pretty like Tom Cruise or you know, Brad Pitt. I have to be funny or scary. So that often means I'm going to be like the funny, scary bad guy. And that puts me into a lot of dark material too. When you mentioned Pan's Labyrinth specifically, or even let's start with the Hellboy movie first, the first Guillermo del Toro film you guys saw me in. You know, when I first got the script for that, I was like, wait, the title of the movie is Hellboy, and the lead character is a demon from hell. So I thought immediately, you know, I got the script in the afternoon one day at the meeting at the office with Guillermo del Toro and the creature effects makeup people and some producers, and they handed me the script and some graphic novels and said, go have at it and get back to us tonight. So I had to go home and just study up as fast as I could. But in the car on the way home, I was already formulating how I'm going to, you know, politely decline this movie, because there's no way I can do a movie where the central character is a demon from hell who's the hero. Well, then I read the script and was like, well, this is so not offensive to me. When I called Guillermo del Toro on the phone and said, as a Christian, why am I not offended at all by a lead character being a demon? Why is that? And he said, well, it was not meant to offend you, my friend. And he said that this is just an example of what we as people have to go through every day, making choices and decisions in our lives, and one of those decisions being, are we going to keep our baggage from the past in our present, and are we going to let it, you know, decide what decisions and choices we make today? So he said, you know, Hellboy, who better to exemplify that than a demon from hell, and what past he might, and what organic past he comes from, but he's an example of cutting that string that ties us to our past and letting us move forward without the baggage that we can weigh ourselves down with, and that, you know, he's a zebra that actually could change his stripes. And so, you know, we as humans are born with a sinful nature, and we can make a choice to there is redemption, there is forgiveness for those sins, my vocabulary is gone right now. It's like always when I'm being interviewed that I'm just searching for a word, and it's like, I know it's there. but it's like, you know, that turning away from that we have the choice to make every day. And I think in the first Hellboy movie, that my favorite scene was one that I wasn't in, was when Hellboy was faced with saving Liz Sherman, played by Selma Blair. She's lying, you know, kind of unconscious, and our evil, the evil.
Rasputin?
Oh gosh, I forget. Rasputin? I forget what. Rasputin. Yes, was you know, had this whole master plan of like getting Hellboy to reclaim his rightful place as the Prince of Darkness, and grow his horns back, and then place his big right hand of doom into like the special lock that unlocks the seven gods of chaos or whatever it was, and so that plan is, you know, underway. And Hellboy is, you know, his love for Liz is what makes him question his you know, his faith and his convictions on who he is now. And so he kind of like goes with this evil plan because there lies Liz, vulnerable and dying. So as he's starting to save her, but then, you know, ruin the world, his horns grow back, and he does stick his hand in, unlocks the seven gods of chaos, and then, but at some point, though, Agent Myers, the young human fella, who was his little sidekick in the movie, throws the crucifix that came from his father, Professor Broom, played by John Hurt. He tosses it to Hellboy and yells at him, "Remember who you are." Hellboy catches that, and it burns a cross image into his palm. And then as it falls to the ground, that cross image is still emblazoned in his palm, and he has a look at it, and that's when he remembers, oh, gosh, I do stand for something bigger and better than whatever this evil plan is, reaches up and cracks off his horns that just grew back. Very, very definitive moment of, I will not be doing evil today. I love that moment. Very empowering for any of us that are faced with a temptation any day of the week. You know, we can reach up and yank our horns off if we want to.
No, it's an absolutely wonderful image. And you know, Guillermo del Toro is, as you said, you know, no one can truly ever get him, but he is a master of capturing visually, you know, these very human moments, even when it's something so fantastical. You know, Pan's Labyrinth, you know, for all of the sort of the magical fairies and this, and, you know, goat monsters and eyeless pale creatures, you know, it's still a sort of family story, right? It's about a girl and her mother and, you know, her baby brother. You know, it's all very tight and small and
very human.
And this is something we've talked about, you know, scripturally. You know, scripture does a wonderful job of having these big epic, you know, things happening, politics, but then sort of always coming back to a small family and the struggles of the small family, whether that's, you know, Mary and Joseph, you know, in the stable, whether that's Samuel's mother, you know, weeping before the altar. You know, there's something about those juxtapositions, which really, when done poorly, can just sort of be schmaltzy and, you know, belittle what sort of message you're trying to make. But when done well, man, does that just stick the knife in and twist it.
I think that, you know, but Christ-like imagery shows up in art all the time, doesn't it? It shows up in movies and TV shows and writing. They'll have a character that is sacrificial or whatever. I enjoyed the Christ-like qualities of the Silver Surfer when I was able to play him, too. Here he was. I mean, his origins was that he went into service to Galactus to save his planet Zenla and save the woman that he loved and the people that he loved and cared about. So if their planet would be spared if he sacrificed himself into service. So he was kind of a reluctant, you know, a hero. But when he comes to Earth, he's got this, you know, this sort of angelic presence about him that's really, really good. That's the part of him I loved and connected with. But when Pan's Labyrinth too, Guillermo del Toro has a Catholic background. Now he might tell you today that he's agnostic, but you know, I think that, but his reverence and his respect for his Christian upbringing is there. He would never make fun of it or mock it. He uses imagery from it all the time in his work. Pan's Labyrinth. Oh my gosh, you can't deny that there is a sacrificial Christ-like story going on with the innocence of that little girl. And the blood of an innocent was necessary at the very end of the movie to finalize this saving of the underworld. And then that would claim her right place at the right hand of the father, which was the king of the underworld. So that imagery was just like, oh, how obvious is that to us, you know? But yet it still was very, very mainstream friendly for an audience. It was a perfect movie, I think. Cause she was supposed to sacrifice her little brother. That's the blood that I was telling her we needed. But in the end, she made the right choice to sacrifice herself instead and save her little brother. So that whole, oh gosh, I mean, that was such a beautiful message. And many people ask me, one of the main questions I get asked about Pan's Labyrinth is, was she on a head trip or did this really happen to her, right? Because at the end, you're thinking, well, was she just, you know, escaping into her own fantasy land because of her horrific situation with her family, with her evil stepfather. There are hints. If you go back and watch the movie again, there are hints that it could be either way all the way through the movie. So Guillermo del Toro did that on purpose, because I asked him this very question. Was it real or was it a fantasy? He said, well, that he left whatever audience member wants it to be. Either one, it can be. So I personally choose for it to be, it really is real, because I want to know that making the right choices and choosing a higher moral path will indeed gain us a rightful place and someplace better after we're gone. So when she was at the end of the movie, she was, you know, dressed in her little silk dress and had her little shiny red shoes on and was all cleaned up. It was like, oh, it was such a great payoff for me to watch and to be a part of that scene when I came around from behind the pillar and bowed to her and said, "You have chosen wisely, Your Highness." It's like, oh, yes. Yes, she did. And I want to know that all of us making that right choice to, you know, to follow Christ and to invite him into our lives, that will indeed pay off and it will get our rightful place, you know, one day, but only by the grace of God. I have no right to it myself, by the way. I've done nothing to earn it. But I think it's a wonderful parallel being spoken there.
One of the things we wanted to talk to you about in light of your role as a Christian in Hollywood is the ministry that you and your wife have, I believe.
Well, you know, I wouldn't know. It's been written up in my bio that, like, we don't have an official ministry.
Well, yes.
It doesn't have a name. but I think, you know, living life every day, we're all in ministry of some sort, mm-hmm. aren't we? And our niche happens to be that, you know, we were never able to have children of our own. I mean, doctor approved, we're sterile. So what came of that was that when we both were okay, in our early 40s, kind of realizing that we weren't going to be having kids raised in our own home, then and we were both okay with that and realized that maybe God has another plan for us personally. A lot of 20-somethings started rolling into our lives. Now, I had always connected with younger people anyway, because especially with me, the more acting credits that I accrued, the more young actors who just moved to LA were interested in talking to me, just for professional reasons. But every so often you'll meet that one young person that there's something more there and a connection happening that's beyond showbiz. And that's when we'll take them in. We call them our puppy. So we can't really call them our kids because they belong to someone else, but we'll call them our puppies. So we've sort of like semi unofficially adopted, you know, 30 some puppies over the years it's not like a halfway house for Hollywood. And it's been misinterpreted as that before some people, I've gotten anonymous messages from people on Facebook and Twitter saying, "Hey, you know, my niece is moving out to LA and needs to, you know, get some connections in showbiz. And I hear you do that for people." I'm like, oh no, that isn't all what it is. I don't have the 1-800 get famous phone number. Nobody has that. So we're not a landing place for showbiz hopefuls. It's more of our home is open to young people that we connect with and have taken time to connect with, and where the connection is actually a godly foreseen thing, where it's supposed to be happening. And that can be any number of things. I do a lot of public speaking and a lot of speaking at acting schools and film schools and, you know, film festivals and whatnot. And every so often there will be that one conversation that happens after an event like that where someone says, "Mr. Jones, can I talk to you a little bit further about something? And something you said really touched me," or something. And a connection that goes beyond the showbiz is what really becomes a puppy situation, you know. So we do open up our home to every so often we'll have a puppy night where we'll invite all of any puppies who are in town here in L.A. To come on over, and we'll put a pot of chili on and start a fire in the backyard and roast marshmallows and talk about life and love. And our sofa is always open to sit on and talk about life and love and issues. And, oh, there's a lot of relationship problems, and, you know, dating in LA is hard. And then couple that with the insecurities of being, a young actor or singer, dancer, director, writer, and the insecurities that come with that, and the instabilities that come with that kind of a profession starting off. You know, so there's a, yeah, it's been a, it's been great for all parties involved. You know, we feel very fulfilled that we get to take on a parental role, because a lot of people in LA, a lot of young people in LA, have moved here from somewhere else, and they might come from a family that they love and miss, and so having a parental, you know, a mom and dad figure that they can come and sit on the sofa and have a bowl of chili is great. If they come from a family that they do not miss and do not love, and there's issues there, then having a mom and dad figure that's safe and comfortable to talk about all that with is another, can be a blessing as well. So these kids are such a blessing to us too. You know, we do feel a sense of fulfilled purpose whenever someone comes through our front door like that.
That's absolutely wonderful. No, and I mean, I remember reading, an article a while back where you talked about this, and that really, really struck me. You know, growing up, both of us actually grew up Baptist. We're in the Anglican world now, but we grew up Baptist and Southern Baptist, and there is this kind of parallel pop cultural stream that you find in the kind of evangelical world. You know, there's sort of a divide from the secular world and the, and especially in the world of art, I find. And there's a firewall that's sort of been put up, and it's always sort of rubbed me kind of in the wrong way. I feel like there's a lot that can be missed out on by sort of walling yourself in and pinning yourself in, and being a very publicly Christian actor. I wondered if you know, folks had ever approached you and say, hey, you know, how come you're not sort of doing more exclusively Christian thing? You know, how come you're not in the, you know, the next Left Behind franchise? You know, things like that. What sort of response have you gotten from that?
Oh yeah, you know, and first of all, you know, the Left Behind type movies and the made for Christian audience movies, there is an audience for them, absolutely. You know, I wouldn't want to poo-poo that form of entertainment and that form of inspiration. But the movies that I and television that I work on is mainstream. But I like to pick content that is going somewhere helpful or useful or inspirational. That's my favorite kind of thing to be involved in. Let me give you an example. For when I did the movie Legion, I did a cameo in the movie Legion with I played the evil ice cream man, and that was a toughie. When I read the script for Legion, I was just doing a cameo, but I knew that they wanted to do a Doug Jones cameo, which meant that the entire movie needed to mean something to me, or I would, if they wanted me to be a part of the press machine and the, you know, and focus someone on, here's a scene with Doug Jones. I kind of wanted to know that I was in something that I could promote. Read the script and was like, oh dear me, goodness. It reads like God is the bad guy, and the title Legion means a legion of angels coming from heaven to inhabit people one at a time and turn them into evil creatures and kind of self-destruct. And it was like, oh my word. So I thought, this needs I need a coffee date with the director, Scott Stewart, to talk about what his vision of telling the story is going to be, because maybe there's something in the script that I'm not seeing that, or a telling of it that he'll twist this into a story that makes sense to me. So that coffee date is what kind of sold me on it. I told him, and I normally don't come right out and say, you know, I'm a Christian and this offends me, because that's what they're waiting for. they're waiting to, oh, here comes another self-righteous Christian who just wants to be offended. Okay. So I never do that. I approach it as an artist first, like usually. Here was a case where I said, artistically, I get your movie, I get your audience, I get what you're doing, and there's a lot of you know, badass kickery, and you know, you've got like you know, angels with machetes and swords, like doing battle, and it's that's cool. I get the Saturday night popcorn movie effect you're going for here. I said, but God is the bad guy, and I don't know if that's a message that I can help tell. So help me with this. And so Scott said, oh well, no. The last thing I want to do is offend anyone with religious convictions of any kind. Let's pretend that the New Testament doesn't exist. Let's pretend that we're still living in Old Testament times, and but yet we're in modern day. Would society, as we look around us, would we be deserving of another flood? that's what got me interested. Now I'm like thinking, oh, well, yes, absolutely. With the Earth as it is right now should be obliterated and start over again. So I thought, oh, okay, I see where you're going now. So it was kind of more of a what if kind of a scenario that he was going for. And so what I saw was the potential of, okay, if I'm going to be a part of the press machine, I didn't look at this as I'm saying yes to this great movie. I was saying yes to the press and the questions that would come up after the movie was out and released. And that if I could be a part of those interviews that happened, I had the opportunity to be a voice of hope and reason when it was active. So sure enough, I did the movie, I did my cameo, and when I was a part of the red carpet premiere and the press junkets and whatnot, and the convention appearances that came with it, the question always came up from the journalists, you know, what's it like being a part of such a you know, controversial piece of work like Legion? And so I was able to say on, you know, all kinds of press outlets, including CNN and, you know, the Access Hollywoods and the whole thing, that this is an entertainment piece. You know, this is a movie that's meant for entertainment purposes. And I said, and I was able to reflect what Scott Stewart told me, that, you know, let's pretend we're in Old Testament times. Are we deserving of a flood? And if you look back at Noah's story, anybody that was not on that ark, you know, really suffered a dismal and hideous, violent death with that when that flood came. So it wasn't pretty, and so so Legion wasn't a pretty movie, and it might have been a modern day reflection of a different kind of a telling of the flood story with that little gas station that the humans were holed up in, being kind of like the ark. So there was an absolute parallel to that story. And I said, but here's the good news. The good news is that's a Saturday night movie experience, but the next morning on Sundays, you're all welcome to come to church with me and hear the rest of the story, because the Bible does have a New Testament, and there is a follow-up to this story that we do have a Savior, and someone came to save us from all this, the destruction. So I said there is good news and there is hope. So that this movie is a great conversation starter. I was able to say that in all the press outlets. So there were some Christian friends of mine that were like, oh, Doug, you know, you really shouldn't have been a part of this movie. And like, I really want to, you know, admonish you to be a part of a more, you know, definable good work, you know, that people really. And I was like, thank you for sharing. I thank you so much for your but I was not in Legion for other Christians to appreciate. I was in Legion for people who are on the fence or don't know or would be asking the question, is God angry enough at us to obliterate Earth right now? That's why I did it for them. Mm-hmm. So that I could talk about, so that it could be a conversation starter for us to have this conversation later. So that's kind of my line of thinking, is where's the whole project going? Is there potential for it? Or are we I say no constantly to films that are gratuitously demonic, or you know, where the bad guy gets to live at the end, you know, because they want to make a sequel or whatever. So I'm turned off by an awful lot of scripts. I'm like, and I'll say no. But this was one that had some redemptive qualities to it. And Scott Stewart also, if you look at Legion, there's a conversation between the Archangel Michael, played by Paul Bettany, and the Angel Gabriel, where they were at war with each other, and they had a conversation about God's intention that was kind of, from the original script to the final movie, was given some truth. It was like, oh, good. So I actually, at the press junket, when I saw director Scott Stewart again, I hugged him and kissed him on the cheek and thanked him for that last scene, with those two angels, because you know, and told him that that was a good positive move. So anyway, that's one. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yeah, no. It's. I think it's. You know, I've been asked before, you know, by folks either in church or in family, you know, like as an actor, you know, what are you willing to do? What are you not willing to do? You know, what do you think is appropriate for you to do? And you know, I wouldn't probably take on a role that advocated genocide, but I mean, I have played Eichmann before, you know, and sort of, you know, where's the line that gets drawn there? And I do, you know, my big work is portraying H.P. Lovecraft, you know, and it's largely done for comedic effect. But he also held some fairly odious personal opinions. And that's, you know, there's a lot of question about, you know, the artist and sort of what the artist creates and glorifying, you know, folks from an era who held particularly problematic views. And is it, you know, particularly good of me, you know, even just as atheism alone, which was pretty militant, you know, that, you know, how to depict that as a Christian becomes a bit of a song and dance. But I think, you're able to find God's grace in a lot of things, and you're able to find beauty in a lot of things. And I think that's what can sometimes get missed out on. I mean, what you've talked about, there's a lot of the films you've been in, you know, have not been explicitly Christian, but they still have elements of redemption, elements of atonement, you know, of healing. And I think that, you know, that message alone can be vital in a fairly cynical world.
Right. And sometimes, you know, I'll be... Hocus Pocus was another little example of, you know, the when I took on that movie, it was like, okay, well, this is a movie with three witches as the central focus of the film, and but I heard rumor that producer Ralph Winter on the movie was also a Christian. Sure enough, we had a conversation on set one day, and I said, "Oh, Ralph, I hear you're a Christian." He goes, "Yes, I am." I said, "Well, then help me feel better about doing a movie where, you know, we've got witches as the central theme." He said, "Well, first of all, the witches are not glorified, and they are not the heroes of the story. The heroes are actually these three kids, mm-hmm. And their brother sister love for each other, and you know, it's more of a family rah rah." Movie that overcomes the witches, and the witches are goofy and doofuses that are not to be emulated. So, okay, that's good. And he said, and the other thing is, you know, as Christians, we can be a part of a film and make choices with our role in it that other people may not do. We can subtly guide the storyline or the moments into a better place. He said, you know, him as a producer, he has decisions to make for the entire picture, you know, every day that could gently nudge it one direction or another. And, you know, and me as an actor in my role, that I have, you know, some say in how that character comes across, right? So one example of that, you know, and it's, again, it's not an example of like, you know, I made a decision that brought people to their knees and repented and, you know, became Christians. It wasn't that kind of a movie, but if you can soften the blow a little bit, maybe that's an important thing to do too. This was a Disney kids film, and it originally scripted for me when I finally cut my mouth open. Mm-hmm. I had those stitches on as Billy Butcherson and coughed out dust and moths. And I look at Bette Midler and I say, the original script wanted me to look at her and just yell, "Bitch!" And that's it. So I was like, and I'm just thinking Disney kids film. That's not. And that was a moment where you were supposed to realize that Billy Butcherson is not on Bette Midler's team. We have history together, but it was ugly history. And I'm actually here to help the kids now. So that was the turning point moment. And I thought just yelling one little semi-profanity at her won't really. Again, as an artist, I had to approach it from that angle and say that I don't know that that's the selling moment you want. And so what's in the movie is a rewrite that I did myself, and I got it approved by our director, Kenny Ortega, and our writer at the time. So what came out instead was calling her a wench, trollop, you bucktooth, mop-riding firefly from hell. And she goes, "Oh!" and screams. And I looked at the kid and said, I've waited centuries to say that. So it just created just a little better moment. It can help soften the blow of just like, you know, teaching kids to call grown women bitches. You know what I'm saying?
I thought. We can approve of that.
Yeah. So, you know, we subtle nudges and softening blows is a part of our deal.
Well, so I feel like we've talked a lot about almost, I don't know, apologizing for involvement in projects or but I mean, is there any way in which you see, I don't know, science fiction, speculative fiction, some of the, I guess, geekier projects that you're involved in as particularly an interesting avenue for exploring issues of faith and Christian themes, even explicitly or subtly?
Yeah, sure. I think so. You know, I think even the current show that I'm on, Falling Skies, You've got your central character, Noah Wiley, playing Tom Mason on the show. And, you know, at the end of season, you know, it's a post-apocalyptic world. The aliens have taken over Earth and have done a hostile takeover. And there's this one faction of humans that are fighting back, led by Noah Wiley. I joined the show in season 3 as another alien race that landed on Earth to, you know, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they're like, where did they come from? And I'm kind of here to help. So again, I was able to offer sort of a Christ-like appearance, you know, and I've stayed with the show now. I've just finished my second season with the show, season 4, which starts airing June 22nd on the TNT, Sunday nights at 10. Had to put the plug in. So my character, Cochise, is the leader of the Volm aliens, and we're here to help. We have technology to help fight back the bad aliens. We have a prior relationship with the bad aliens for centuries. You know, we've all known each other, been fighting battles on other planets and other galaxies. So it's like that's when the humans realize, oh, there's something out there bigger than ourselves. Obviously, they already knew that from the hostile takeover, but now that there's a good element coming to save them from it and help them on their battle, it's like, again, that's Christ-like imagery, you know, where you've got, you know, when you're looking at insurmountable, you know, issues and chaos, and then something lands in your lap that says, oh, it's we're not defeated, and there is a way out, and there is hope. I love stories that can go there unapologetically. Again, I don't ever feel like apologizing for you know, artistic choices like that, you know.
That's wonderful.
Yes. Now, I have one final thing that I would kick myself if I didn't ask you about. As being the huge fan of Joss Whedon that I am, I must ask you about your work on Hush.
Oh, yes. The Hush episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Well, yes, there's another show like that too. You know, when with the element of humor that was brought into Buffy, when things are funny, all bets are off. You know, it's like if we're doing something just for the funny, come on. So Buffy the Vampire Slayer is just a fun, smart, brilliant show, and that Hush episode was very cutting edge because Joss Whedon, you know, as a showrunner, head writer on a show, and executive producer, you know, they approve everything on the show, but he came out of his office to write that episode and direct it himself, mm-hmm. which is kind of a big deal. By season 4, he had, because every episode is directed by somebody different, and they have a whole team of writers, and so everyone's personnel is changed out episode by episode on a series like that. So for him to have written and directed that episode was kind of special. And when he wrote these characters to steal the voices from everybody in Sunnydale Sunnyvale, is it? Wait, which
Sunnydale.
Is it? Dale with a D. I got it right. Okay. What's Sunnyvale? Okay. Anyway. So that meant that over half the episode was done in complete silence with no verbal dialogue. And for a network TV show to pull that off had never been done before. So the WB or whatever the show was on at that point time was like, oh, they were a little bit nervous about this choice and we're trying to talk Joss out of it. And, you know, but I think it was, again, when you have a brilliant genius running a show like that, you have to trust them. And sure enough, it was the opposite. Instead of them, their worry that if we aren't stimulating visually and audibly, that people will lose interest and change the channel, it was quite the opposite. You take their hearing away, and they lean in like this to make sure they don't miss one beat of that show. So Hush was absolutely that experience, you know. And it garnered Emmy nominations and the whole thing. So it was just a genius piece of work to be a part of.
Well, I still think about that, the image where, you know, someone's looking out the window and the gentleman just floats by and turns and mm-hmm. smiles. And it's probably the most terrifying scene in all of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's just so sure. powerful.
Was that your first action figure?
No, my first action figure was the Mac Tonight campaign from McDonald's.
That's right, of course.
Wait, I was toys in the Happy Meals, and I was beach towels and sippy cups and lunch boxes and all kinds of things.
How did that feel?
Oh, well, yeah. But the thing is, it's like you go out in public and you see, you know, billboards and you see toys and the people playing with their toy, and you want to go, that's me. But, you know, it doesn't look like me, so I couldn't really, you know, prove it.
Were you able to carry the giant moon face around just to point at people and be like, me?
I had a crew production jacket, like a satin, like baseball jacket with the Mac Tonight logo on the back and the moon head. So I wore that a lot and would turn around a lot and be like, you know, hey, can you see the back? And, you know, aren't you going to ask me why I'm wearing this jacket? That's kind of what I.
So from King's Island to Mac Tonight, have we now bookended the illustrious career of Doug Jones?
I guess so. I mean, it doesn't get better than those two, really, if you think about it.
I guess so. Right. Seriously. Yeah, no, but action figures. That was unusual too for the gentleman to become action figures, and we were 12-inch dolls and 6-inch figures and statues and busts and all. And you know, there have been T-shirts and, you know, many things with that image on it. And for a guest star role on a TV show to be made into that much fuss over was unusual and groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. You know. But since then I was also my Warriors of Virtue character. It was a Kung Fu Kangaroo movie, Warriors of Virtue. I was made an action figure for that. And oh golly, of course, Abe Sapien from the Hellboy movies, many toys and figures from that. And the Silver Surfer, many toys and figures and artwork from that. So it goes on and on. Yeah, it's been kind of crazy. I have rooms full of plastic boxes I haven't opened because I wanted them to keep their value.
Oh, wonderful. You know what I mean? Have to keep that mint.
Yeah, you're right.
And I know you've got a couple of projects coming up. You're actually collaborating or at least somehow involved with some of my friends in the Lovecraft zine. I know they have a big Kickstarter for short films they're working on.
They do. It's kind of a web series, but it's sort of like an anthology web series where each episode will be its own self-contained
story. Sort of
Twilight
Zone-ish, I think, was what that's sort of how they're selling it. Right. So that was exciting to see you pop up on my Facebook feed. Yeah. I have my friends there.
Yeah, I'm ever hopeful that this will happen. I believe that they're filming back in my home state of Indiana. So, you know, any reason to get back home to Indiana, I'm in for. But it was supposed to be maybe hopefully sometime this summer. But because there's a Kickstarter campaign attached to this whole thing, which means they may not have all their money yet. And so I'm waiting to see and hear
where that goes.
Dates.
The Falling Skies coming out in June. What else can we look forward to? You had a successful Kickstarter film because I saw that popping around as well, where you were in some delightful demonic looking makeup.
A couple of them. Oh gosh, yeah. Well, one was called The Visitant,
yes.
a short film that'll be showing in festivals starting this summer, and then another, and that was with Amy Smart, and produced by John Heder, who played Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh, wow.
Another short film called Kiss the Devil in the Dark. Yes. You might have seen a lot of imagery from that one.
That's where I played.
Yeah, I played Terrence the Butler, who turns into this hideous demon and. And again, that was made up in Utah last summer, and that'll be also starts showing in film festivals this summer. More dates coming up. June 3rd is going to be a DVD video release date for a couple of things. One is season 3 of Falling Skies will finally be out on DVD. It's been streamable and downloadable on your video on demand outlets so far. But now season 3 will be available on DVD. The box set will be out June 3rd, and that's last season. So if you can watch and catch up on season 3 just in time to see season 4 in its first airings Sunday nights at 10 on TNT starting June 22nd. Okay. And then also June 3rd is the video on demand release, iTunes, Amazon, and whatever outlets you can find for an indie film I did called Dust of War. It's another post-apocalyptic story. It takes place on the plains of South Dakota, and you're following a few people on their journey. It's been an alien invasion, but they don't really focus on the aliens at all. It's kind of like the people who are on the run from them, and they happen to come across a band of merry minstrels that are, you know, in this dank, dismal post-apocalyptic world. There's these traveling minstrels that sort of like lighten the mood, and I get to play Jebediah Strum, a southern boy who's joined this posse of entertainers, And so I get to have some comedic lighter moments in the film. So Dust of War is going to be interesting. Tony Todd, who played the Candyman, is also in that band of merry minstrels with me. So you'll enjoy Dust of War. May 20th, just next week on Tuesday, is the DVD release of Raze, R-A-Z-E, starring Zoe Bell, action star Zoe Bell. She's like a stunt woman who's turned actress, and she's absolutely amazing in this. And now this is a brutal, brutal film. And it does, you might think that it borders on gratuitous violence, but it actually is, it's a hideous story of, I play the patriarch of an elite society of people that abducts women, forces them to fight each other in an underground prison. I know that sounds like really like, okay, really, but there are no nudity scenes. There's no gratuitous, like, you know, chicks fighting chicks kind of a scene. It's more, it's really, it's visceral and violent, but it's also very heart driven with like these poor women and looking through their stories and their backstories and what. And it poses the question, what lengths would a woman go to protect the ones she loves? And it's very empowering to that female spirit, after all. So Zoe Bell wouldn't be involved if it didn't have some kind of women kicking ass kind of a storyline. And my wife in the movie, who plays, she's the matriarch of this weird society of people that makes them do it. My wife, played by Sherilyn Fenn, TV screen icon from Twin Peaks.
All right.
So all right. She played Audrey in the show. Yeah. And several movies since then. But she's to work face to face with her was just an absolute dream. So that's May 20th, the next Tuesday, coming out on DVD. Raze, R-A-Z-E. But wait, there's more.
You're actually involved, with the Blue Hornets film view, yes?
Marble Hornets, yes. Marble Hornets was a web series that was inspired by Slender Man, yes. And the Marble Hornets folks were approached about having their property made into a movie called The Operator. So in The Operator, I play the title character of The Operator. So it is a really, really super cool take on that legend that was started on the internet. Yeah. That's coming out hopefully sometime later this year. They don't have a release date yet, but they're aiming for Halloween time in the fall. And then also, speaking of Halloween next year, 2015, will be the release of Guillermo del Toro's new haunted house story called Crimson Peak, in which I play, I'm not allowed to tell you, but Guillermo del Toro did say, I could tell you it's a haunted house story. Make them guess.
And that's the one that was filmed in Toronto, or at least parts of it were filmed in Toronto?
That was filmed in Toronto, yes, in its entirety. Yeah, it takes place in, I think, Buffalo, New York, and then part of it takes place in England, but they shot it in Toronto. And I also just did a guest cameo in the season finale of Guillermo del Toro's TV series, The Strain. It's a vampire story, a series based on a series of books that he co-wrote called The Strain. So that'll be a fun one. I don't do much, but when you see me, you'll get a hint that I might be showing up next season sometime.
Oh, wonderful! Okay. That's great.
And I'm in a full makeup. You won't recognize me. Okay.
Well, thank you so much for being on our show. I know folks can follow you on Twitter.
Yes. If you look for me on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook or LinkedIn, you can find, if you do a Doug Jones search, you might find me easy enough. But if you can't, having trouble, you can search Actor Doug Jones. All run together, no punctuation, Actor Doug Jones, and you'll get right to my pages.
Well, that's absolutely wonderful. Well,
thank you again for your time and your reflections.
That's right. So we're heading on out from the world of faith, family, and fandom in no particular order. This has been Geekfully Yoked.
Across the room,
and I catch your eye.
You give me a cryptic wink.
You turn away so shy.
Ignite that passion.
Blame it on you.
And
and so I search most earnestly
for a board game for two.
I want to spend the night gaming with you. We'll read our cards by candlelight.
The candles burn down low.
You seem to have won again.
Is it me or is it cold?
Set it up one more time.
This is what I call romance.
Lady Luck smiles down on you.
Wait, is that a jealous glance?
Moving pieces side by side.
Try gaming with you.
That's it. I am done with this gaming with you.
What? You're going. We're not finished
gaming with you.
Come on, won't you play again?
Gaming with you.
If you want, I can let you.